Okay, welcome to the South by Southwest 2008 presentation on body optimization.
Woo!
Awesome. We have some optimizers in the front row already here. So I'm Tantek Celik, your host. Thanks. Nice. I have here with me Catherine Myronic, am I right? And Noel Murata. And Sean Bonner. So I bet a lot of you are wondering, like, what is a session like this doing? At South by Southwest. And like, what? Like, isn't this the interactive conference? Like, what does this have to do with any of this stuff? Well, I think one of the things I've learned about South by Southwest after coming here for 7 years is that this is among any sort of conference that deals with the web or interactive or interfaces, development, that kind of thing, probably the biggest conference that questions assumptions, figures out how to simplify things. A lot of really simple technologies that are very powerful got created here. And being unconventional is a really big thing here. And just hacking. And so I was like, well, you know, why not our bodies as well as, you know, that's the ultimate interface, right? With the world is your body. So, but you might know me from, you know, the first HTML4 CSS1 PNG compliant browser from Microsoft, which is unconventional, back in 2000, and then the CSS box model hack, you know, for Windows. Or the meaningful elements of XHTML, right? You know, for data. These are all things that were unconventional and very much like not the way people are used to doing things. And of course, a little thing called microformats. But why? So this really, this really was the result for me. It started with a personal wake-up call. And I don't know if there's anyone else here that's had like similar experience. We can talk about during Q&A. But this started for me back in 2006. I got a physical, like the first physical I've gotten in like years. I don't even remember the previous time I got in a physical, so it was pretty bad, right? And I'm like, okay, whatever, get a physical. Finally got around to doing it. And I got hit with some very bad shocking news. One was the whole cholesterol is being way too high. I'm like, well, I'm not really eating that badly. What am I doing? My blood sugar was too high. And this is the one that really kind of freaked me out, because the doctor was like, hey, yeah, you know, you keep on doing what you're doing, and in 5 to 10 years, you'll have diabetes. It's like, what? Like, I never really thought of myself as an unhealthy person, and so this was one of those, like, holy crap moments, right? And I was overweight. I was about 200 pounds with clothes, and the doctor was like, you need to lose some weight. This is no good. You know, for your frame, I'm 5'11". It's like, this is no good. It was basically a confrontation of, you know, a bunch of trends that are going on for me personally that was no good. And, you know, once in a while, I'd see these photos on Flickr and be like, wow, is that really me? Like, yuck. It was just totally embarrassing. And I'd almost been like, well, should I ask him to take that photo down? Like, no, because it really is me. It's not like it's dishonest or, you know, photoshopped or anything. No, that's what it is. So I made some immediate changes from the doctor. So they said, okay, cut the fried food. Just like cut fried food, that'll help cure cholesterol right away. And then if you cut out foods with corn syrup, that'll at least cut out the foods that are spiking your blood sugar or causing a big insulin response and essentially, you know, causing some of that insulin resistance, which results in a continuous high blood sugar, which then eventually results in diabetes. With that, I dropped 185 pounds in like a couple months. Okay, so the really simple immediate changes like made some difference right away, but I was really still unhappy. Like, it didn't sort of like make any sort of really big difference in my life. And the next real step came for me was when I complained to a friend of mine, I don't know if she's here, Leah Culver. And she basically was like, she pushed back. She confronted me like, well, she's like, okay, look, she was basically sick and tired of hearing me bitch about this. And she's like, look, if you really want to change this, you can, but you have to really want to, right? And this is probably one of the biggest things that anyone dealing with changing themselves in any way, whether it's like physical, psychological, mental, anything you want to prove yourself, your number one challenge is to actually convince yourself that you want to do it so badly that you're actually going to commit to doing it. It's pretty hard, but peer pressure works. So if your friends are complaining to you, push back, because it did definitely work for me. She gave me a really simple plan, and this is kind of deceptively simple, and I'll tell you why. The first was to keep a food log, so you practice writing down everything that you're eating, that kind of thing. The second was to start the actual, like, changing what you're doing, a 48-hour fast, and that, a juice fast, like basically 2 glasses of juice per day for 48 hours. And, you know, do it over the weekend when you don't have any commitments, et cetera, et cetera. And then the two components that are ongoing was a calorie budgeted diet for slow weight loss. So basically go online, find a calorie calculator, figure out, given my age and height and gender and all that, what calories should I be eating per day? Turned out for me it was about 1,800. And then this structured exercise program of like three times a week, like this time of day, do this exercise. I was like, okay, just do that. And that's a simple plan, right? However, it was actually pretty difficult. I was grumpy. Right. Anyone who's ever fasted knows that. You get grumpy pretty fast. The psychological component of having to fight various food cravings was really, really bad, right? Like, say, for cupcakes. You know, anyone here like cupcakes? Yeah, okay. Or donuts or French fries or... Yeah, it's not good, is it? But literally, like, okay, those things I just had to cut. Like, did I want those foods or did I, you know, which I tasted before. It's not like it was a new taste or some new experience. Or did I want to actually like change myself? Well, social awkwardness. Anyone here ever like change their diet and have to deal with like social awkwardness situations like all the time? Like say you decide to not drink or something or like, you know, you're whatever, right? It's really awkward. People want to buy you drinks. Plus one thing I found out really quickly, it's actually pretty lonely to like completely alter your diet. So many of the social functions we do are based around food. It was amazing. Like just going out to lunch or dinner or whatever, gone, right? Like I couldn't do those things or just what am I going to do? Go sit at the table and not eat? That's awkward too. So it was kind of odd doing that. It basically means you have to cook for yourself if you're going to calorie count hardcore. Okay, the first month, it took me 2 weeks to get into a routine, 1 month to really see and feel results, but that was enough to just keep me going. Like if you can stick with it for a month, you can probably keep doing it. Like that's pretty much what I learned. And that's good to know so that while you're struggling, you know, with all the emotional aspects of it, you know, okay, let me just keep doing it and see what happens. But then for me, the real kind of like, whoa, something different has happened moment came. So I started this in October 2006 and then, end of February, beginning of March, right before South by Southwest 2007 was when I had my like, okay, I'm trying to pack and none of the clothes I have fit. And it was really weird. I was like, okay. It's like, any of you read Metamorphosis, Kafka, right? So this was a very Kafka-esque experience, like waking up one day and like none of your clothes fit. Okay, but in a good way, right? Like you're like, okay, who are these other people's clothes? Did someone come in and just swap out all my clothes with the same clothes but larger? Like, it was just weird. You even have like separation anxiety, like that favorite jacket or that favorite t-shirt that you've been wearing for years and wearing out, and you're like so comfortable, it doesn't fit anymore. Just really weird type, you know, emotional things you don't ever expect to actually have. So I went on a shopping binge, you know. Who here likes to shop? Like most people. It's like a good emotional thing as well. And then decided that I really should share my experience because this was so, it was like surreal, getting back to kind of like the fitness levels I was back in college. So why are we here? We're here because there are a lot of assumptions around fitness and health and how you can improve your body and like, should you be taking pills or medicines for everything? Or should you just be at least like stop eating crappy food to begin with, which is a lot cheaper. What can you do that's simple? What are simple hacks you can do, both just, you know, in your life in general and even here at South by Southwest? And how can you be unconventional, right? That's really what I've got this panel of experts here to come talk about. And next I'd like to introduce, and all of this, by the way, is on a wiki, of course. I'd like to introduce Sean Bonner, who's going to tell us a little bit about what is it like to be a vegan and, you know, not have to have a regular exercise program. Sean.
Hi. Okay, so I guess my history on this is back when I was like around 12, 13, I decided that I was going to change the world and become vegetarian, much to my entire family's dismay. And I have an uncle who's a doctor who assured my whole family that I'd be dead in within a year from trying something as stupid as that. And, but I was like, F you guys, I'm totally doing it. And, so I stuck with it and it turned out to be way, way, way easier than I thought. And, I was sort of doing it for like ethical reasons, like animal rights and, you know, didn't really care too much about the health stuff, but, started noticing, a bunch of things. I had a lot more energy. I was like skating, doing things, able to do it a bit better than before that. Over the few years from that point, I realized that, meat was just kind of like one thing, but dairy was really, really the big problem. Like, you know, milk, exist to like make a little cow, like a really big fat cow, really quickly. And so like eating this all the time, like was sort of counteracting everything that I was doing, any sort of activity or whatever. So I just had to see what it would be like to cut that out, when I was 18. And I did that. I thought I really sort of did it thinking that I was just going to try it out for maybe like a month or two and it would probably be way too difficult and I would give it up. But it turned out to not be difficult at all. And I instantly lost a ton of weight and, regular food started tasting better. I had more energy. I stopped getting sick. Like I couldn't even believe how many things were suddenly better after just like 6 or 7 months of cutting out, eating any kind of dairy. That was 15 years ago. And it's been pretty fantastic since then. On the diet anyway, but it's really not something I even think about at this point. It's such routine, such habit. You just know like what I can eat, what I can't eat. But especially with, it gaining sort of popularity, it's really easy to do it any place. And I don't really have to alter too much. I eat with my friends any place. I have my own stuff.
And you've been doing this for a while, but don't we have a mutual friend who did this, you know, for a very short period of time and got some kind of crazy results, right?
Yeah. Last year, Joey Ito, a friend of ours, sort of jumped on that bandwagon, for the same sort of thing. Like he realized that, like, he just had to make a drastic change in his life, figure something out. And, he actually took it a bit further. He was on an actually sort of a regimented diet that was at its core was a vegan diet, but it also, restricted like, some refined sugars, some refined flour, like a lot of other restrictions into it that he did for 6 months. Noticed radical change, lost a ton of weight, you know, like everything improved across the board. And then he cut back to pretty much just a standard vegan.
And he didn't have an exercise program?
Not that I know of. I think that he had more energy and then became more active because of it, but it wasn't like, you know, diet plus exercise, whatever. And same thing with me. Like I don't really, I've tried a couple different things. I was a totally fat kid. And so like I was always, when I was young, I was like, I gotta figure out ways to lose weight and whatever. And I was always trying to do exercise and trying to do things and none of it ever worked. And I just don't have the, I guess the self-discipline or whatever to like commit to any sort of program like that. I don't like regiment and, following rules and things. And so,
something as crazy like a calorie budget or something.
Yeah,
right?
A calorie budget or like, you know, committing to like a certain like workout plan or like anything like that. I just couldn't do it. I'd do it for like a week or two or, you know, and I'd just fall off or whatever. So I had to figure out a way that if I was going to actually be active, because it's really easy for me not to be active. I can sit in front of my laptop for like 40 hours straight. And
I don't know anyone else like that.
Yeah.
You know? I mean,
exactly.
Seriously?
So like I need to figure out if I'm going to not have a completely sedentary lifestyle, it has to be something that's built into my regular routine as opposed to like, oh, I'm going to now go to the gym and be healthy or whatever. And so that's when I made a decision early on last year that I was going to stop driving every place that I could and start using my bike to try to get around as much as possible.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah, I live in Los Angeles.
Wait, that sounds pretty crazy. I mean,
it's way more doable than you think. and so, yeah, I actually sold my car, in August of last year because I just never, ever, ever use it. And I ride my bike everywhere.
Anybody here from LA? Anybody here? Oh, we've got some LA folks. Okay. All of you have cars, I assume. Any of you not have a car from LA? Oh, impressive. Nice.
Yeah. So that's sort of my rough story.
Cool.
So, I mean, how many miles a week, month, day do you think you ride?
Well, my house and my office are about 5 miles apart. So at very least, I probably ride 10 miles a day going to and from. But I have a, you know, like sort of being like a crazy bike guy in Los Angeles, you sort of find other crazy.
Are you in a gang or something? What's going on?
Yeah, there's yeah. so like I ride bikes with other people in Los Angeles. And so like we have, you know, put together rides and try to figure out other parts of the city that, you know, you wouldn't normally go to or you wouldn't be associated with, or, you know, just like I live in the city. I love the city. So I want to like find out about the city. And the best way to do that is like ride my bike to parts of the city that I don't ever have a reason to be in otherwise. So we're constantly routing new maps and routes and things around. I do like, you know, one or two of those a week. And those are anywhere from 20 or 30 miles to start up to 50 or 60, depending on what they are. I do those all the time. So,
wow.
At least 10 miles a day, but often way more.
That's pretty amazing. So you've been biking how long before you could do this?
Well, I always had a bike for one way or another, but I never really used it for actual transportation until very recently. Like, it was just sort of a recreation thing. Like, you know, once a month or once every other month, I would like meet up with my friends and go on like a 10, 15 mile ride or something. It was like leisure, not something I really paid too much attention to. But now that I ride all the time.
But you sold your car when again?
I sold my car in August of last year.
Okay. So this is pretty recent then.
Yeah, definitely.
Like the riding everywhere thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it like multiplies. Like the more I do, the more I'm able to do and the more I want to do.
That's interesting. So that, I mean, I think that's a really important point. It's like all these incremental changes, like all of a sudden open new doors. Then you right. like take that option and you're like, oh, that opens another door. And then that's like, I think a common theme that like I've encountered as well. Like I would cut off one type of bad food. Then like other foods that, you know, were bad would start tasting less good. And then I'd cut that off. And then like, you know, like you're saying, like the refined sugars is another one. Like you start with cutting out anything with corn syrup, which is pretty darn hard. Corn syrup's like in everything practically. And then you're like, oh, well, let's cut out like refined flours and sugars. And that's like all this stuff that spikes your glucose level, right? It's like no good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really know anything about that. Like I never really got into the huge like health aspects of it. Like, I've talked to doctors and I know that there are the benefits. And so that sort of just encourages it and I just run with it. But as far as like the actual science of what's going on, like I just know that dairy stuff's bad and I stay away from it.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But I do eat fried food all the time.
So Noel, how about you? Have you like altered your diet in any specific way, like recently or long term or?
Recently, no. But I guess my history is a lot longer term. In 1999, I quit a job that had basically free everything, free soda, free snacks. And, you know, I was sitting in front of my computer between 10 and 15 hours a day. So, you know, you go and go to soda machine, get a soda, come back and, you know, multiply that by 3 or 4 times a day. And I don't know, just by the end of the job term, I just felt terrible. I just felt like sluggish and not fat, just like I didn't feel good in my body. So basically from that point, soda, a lot of snacks and fast food just went out the window. And then in about 2001, I had a job with a free gym membership. So I start going once a week when I felt like it. Kind of like Sean, I didn't really have a routine about it. I just went whenever I felt like it. But you know, it kind of feels good to work out. So I started going 2 or 3 times a week. And really liked how the changes in my body, you know, more endurance, more energy. And then in about 2003, the same year that I went to Burning Man, I found a yoga teacher that I really liked.
What a coincidence, right?
Sorry?
Yeah, Burning Man, yoga.
Well, the it was just a coincidence, but I was going to bring another topic into that as well. So at Burning Man, you're supposed to drink a lot of water, gallons of water a day, just to stay hydrated. So that same year, I started drinking at least 2 to 4 liters of water a day. And that actually made a vast difference in how I felt in my body, how, like, I was able to not be compelled to, I don't know, it's hard to put words around, I'm sorry.
Well, there's one definite thing that I've read. I need to look up the source for this, but like a lot of people, because they're so dehydrated, mistake thirst for hunger.
For hunger, right.
Which is a massive problem. Which basically means like you get thirsty, which is totally natural, and you can drink as much water as you want, pretty much, right? Like as much water as your body says you need to drink. But if instead you substitute that with food, then of course what happens? You just end up eating too much food.
Too much food.
So like how many of you have a water bottle like this or something similar here? Okay. Those of you that don't, I highly recommend you get one because you're doing a lot of walking around in a lot of pretty dry air, especially in here, and it'll make a massive difference in like how well you feel just during the conference. Like if that's like one little, you know, hack that you do, like the bottle of water, just pick one up and then keep refilling it.
Yeah, I've also learned that from Burning Man that you don't know how thirsty you are. You really can't feel it. It's actually something you just have to say, I need to be drinking this much water, given the temperature, given the dryness of the air. And so you go to Burning Man and you learn to practice doing that. And then when you get home, you start realizing, oh, wait, I haven't been drinking enough.
Cool. Yeah, it's something you notice exactly when you get back and you're not thinking about drinking that much water in a day. And it just clicks off in your head.
So let's get back to yoga. I mean, is that really exercise? I mean, isn't that just kind of like stretching?
It really depends on what style of yoga you're doing, but no. Actually, it's actually a cardiovascular activity because you're synchronizing your body motions with your breath. In a good class, they're leading you through that. So it actually does regulate your cardiovascular activities. So it actually is an exercise that is cardiovascular. Depending on the class, though, you can do it a lot slower versus a lot more rigorous styles, basically. So depending on what avenue you choose. So anyway, I started going to this one particular teacher's class that I really liked. He was only giving one class a week, so that's when I was going. Once a week, same teacher, same class, same time. And then he got more classes. So I started going 3 or 4 times a week. And after about a year or so of doing this, I felt like I really wanted to get deeper into the practice. So I started an immersion program. So this basically added 16 hours a month to my regular 3 to 4 time a week yoga practice. And let's see, that pretty much brings us up to the end of 2006. And I started climbing with Tantek April of last year.
But you went and got certified
certified as a yoga teacher in late 2006.
So it sounds like you did it pretty recently. It's not like you've been doing yoga like your whole life. It's like you picked it up, you did it because you liked it, and then...
Yeah, I mean, this is probably about a 5 or 6 year old project that, I mean, I've just come to appreciate more and more. So it's become a part of, I don't know, who I am.
So I think a really important lesson here that, like, both from Sean and Noah's examples is, like, if you find something you like bicycling or yoga, just keep doing it. And you know, if you just keep making the things that you like that are active, like just a habit, then it all adds up.
Definitely.
It's really cool. Now, Catherine's been doing like a lot of this research in this area for quite some time, right? How long have you been working on the whole area of life extension?
Since 2004.
Okay. So you work for Ray Kurzweil's office, right?
Yeah. How many people know who Ray Kurzweil is? And how many people know how many vitamins and supplements he takes a day, or have heard that he takes a lot?
Okay, not everyone knew who Ray Kurzweil is. How many people know what the singularity is? Okay, even fewer. How many people have seen Terminator? Okay, Skynet. You know what Skynet is. Okay, there we go.
All right, so number 2.
All right.
All right, so I'll introduce myself. Knowledge sommelier is my fancy way of saying that I'm a data consultant. I have loved working with data all of my life, and that is what I've been doing for my career. I think my one claim, it's not really to fame, but it is something that I did. I think I'm the first person in the world to have ever read 1 million spam.
Emails?
Spam emails, yes, because I was working at Brightmail, which is the first company to have gotten that large of a collection to play with. And I like working with data. I think I'm pretty comfortable with data. You know, that's what I do. But when I started working for Ray Kurzweil and started working on his books, for example, his 2004 book, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, you know, there's a book with 300 pages and 1,200 references. And as part of a follow-up project, I was going through and reading all of those references. And so I'd known about all of these things that we should do for years. You know, my background is in biology. I studied air pollution epidemiology. I just had a general sense of, yes, there's stuff I should be doing that I'm not doing now. But there's an overwhelming amount of data. So, I figure, if myself, who studies data, who's got a background in statistics and analysis and biology, if it's hard for me to deal with it, then, how do you apply it to the regular world? So my talk is, or what I think about is, what is the one thing you should be taking this year? And of course, we've all heard about, you know, the history of the world is filled with ideas. You know, there's one wonderful thing that you should be able to take, and your life is going to be immensely better. And now there's even more information like that. So here's an example of, you know, if you go into the medical literature and you're looking for small genetic changes that different people have, you know, 10 years ago, you looked for this and there was about 75 articles on it. Now there's about 17,000 articles on it. These are the sort of articles where you say, you know, mutations or, you know, variant in APOE in Eastern European populations and how it relates to heart disease. Well, maybe you've got Eastern European ancestry, and so maybe it might apply to you. But how do you know? Well, along with the floods of data, what might go wrong, nowadays we're also getting to the point where you're going to be able to find out your own information. You're going to be able to take control of your own information. So being able to sequence your entire genome, you know, up until recently, only Bill Gates would have been able to afford it. Now most multimillionaires can afford it. You can buy it right now for $350,000. That's not terribly interesting yet because there's not that many people who can do it. But 10 years from now, or maybe even less, you're going to be able to buy your entire genome for $1,000. So now what happens when you've got that data and you're able to do an outer join of that data against all these other data sets about what is associated with what? You know, you suddenly discover you happen to have that gene which is associated with increased risk of heart attack. Well, what are you going to do? Well, maybe there's nothing you can do. Maybe there's a bunch of stuff that you can do. But to be able to start, you have to know where to find information. You have to know what to do. And then you have to be able to do it. I mean, it sounds pretty obvious. So in science, one thing that's new, and one of the things which is, you know, they talk about in this singularity is the amount of information keeps on increasing, is that in the old days, all that we could find out about supplements and vitamins and healthcare is correlation. You could look at a large population, you could say, well, it looks like most people who take vitamin C have slightly fewer colds. Well, great. How does that apply to you? Nowadays, and the thing that's different than ever before, is we can go in and say, all right, it looks like most people who are taking vitamin C have slightly less colds. Let's go into the biochemistry and see if there's a particular reason why vitamin C is helping with the colds. Another thing which is different in science today that did never exist before is instead of doing drug discovery, all right, let's test 1,000 medicines and see if any of them help with colds. We might be able to go in and say, okay, here's a cold virus. Let's just build something that fights the cold virus and nothing else. I'm going to give an example, anti-anxiety medicines. If you've ever had to have an anti-anxiety medicine, you'll find that, you know, doctors don't want to prescribe it to you for very long because it can be addictive. Well, they finally went and said, okay, why are these addictive? I mean, otherwise it seems pretty good. You have somebody who has social anxiety, you have somebody who's speaking on a panel and they want to be able to stay relaxed. You know, why not take it in the long term? Well, they looked at the structure of the receptor sites and discovered the medicines were hitting three different areas, two of which help with anxiety and one of them which causes addiction. Well, why not design a drug that only hits the ones which are anti-anxiety? And there's phase two trials where that's going on right now. And the other thing which is new, and I think really wonderful, is that we've got all of this data, but we also have an immense ability to be able to collectively work with this data and help each other. So there's, you know, a lot of people who are working on it. There's blogs, there's forums, there's tools, there's spreadsheets, there's, you know, things like, you know, Real Age, where you can go in and put in your information and they'll tell you, you know, are you relatively healthy for your age? Maybe what you're doing, you're actually much older than you think you are. Your body is less healthy than you should be.
You mean like things like smoking or?
Yeah, all of these things. Too much red meat, not enough exercise. Right now for a little bit of, you know, it's kind of expensive, but it's only going to get cheaper. You can do things like, you know, participatory genetics. You can sequence not your entire genome, but 600,000 interesting SNPs. Those are those individual small changes for $1,000. Well, all right, so you have this big data set, who cares? But you can get together with a bunch of other people, in this case of this company, 23andMe, and you can work together to say, all right, you know, here's my SNPs, and here are things that I know about myself. I am, you know, prone to getting depression, and maybe you'll find 200 other people in the group who are prone to getting depression, and they can look at the data set and say, okay, well, here's some genes that we weren't expecting to be correlated. and yet they are. So you're helping other people, you know, you're helping doing genetic discovery.
So when they do things like that, like you're prone to depression, how do they control for all the other random factors? I mean, there's so many things like diet and exercise that totally alter mood.
Well, it depends on how much information you put in there. I mean, there's a ton of data, but again, the tools are getting better. Yeah, you know, you only have 200 people, that's not enough. But what if you're something like this, instead of costing $1,000, costs $50, and so you can get 1 million people participating? Suddenly these extraneous factors, you can start weeding them out. Or another one, now this is, you know, $3,000, you can go to Kronos, where they do a medical checkup the way you go at the Mayo Clinic, but they're also putting you into a longitudinal study where they're going to compare you over time, they, you know, hoping you come back every 3 years. So you're not just finding out about your own health, but you are participating in studies which are going to go into peer-reviewed journals and help teach other people about their own health. So, yeah, I'm somebody, as I say it, I know all of this information. How did I figure out what I should be doing for myself? Because it's really overwhelming. So I say, you know, what is the one thing you should be taking this year? And really, it's just, what is the one thing which is going to help you the most? It's going to be the thing you didn't do last year. Because, you know, if you're not taking it, really everything else that you're doing doesn't matter. And also you take something which is going to help you in the future. All right, so what's the first thing? I think the first thing that people should take, I say cognitive behavioral therapy. Because if you're trying to approach your health and you're looking at your results and you're thinking about you need to exercise or you need to eat better and it's just stressing you out, you're not going to do it. So why not give yourself a tool which reduces that stress?
So you mean like seeing a counselor kind of thing?
Yeah, seeing a counselor. You know, learning what it is about yourself where you're saying, you know I need to go to a dentist, but I'm just not going to it. I know I need to eat better, I'm just not doing it. Well, why? Maybe it's a fairly simple thing to solve. So you're giving yourself the tool to be able to handle all the next steps that you should do.
Is this sort of like pair programming? You get someone else to look at your bugs, you know?
Yeah. It's exactly like that.
Okay.
So another thing you should take this year, if you're smoking, I think you should take nicotine gum. Nicotine actually can be quite a helpful chemical. There's some evidence that if you've got a family history of Parkinson's, it might be a very useful thing to take. But particulate matter is not a useful thing, not useful to take into your lungs. And it doesn't matter if it's coming from smoking or if it's coming from diesel exhaust. And here I'm going to give an example. You know, they've known that particulate matters for a long time are killers. It's only been in the past year that they came up with a study of the biochemical pathway of why it's a killer. And it has to do with the, you know, chemicals get into your lungs and it releases interleukins, which makes your blood sticky, which means that more people are going to the hospitals and dying of heart attacks and strokes. And again, this is an example of, you know, top down. You know, so you can look at a population, you can see the people who are smoking, there's more deaths, or people who live in a highly polluted area, there's more deaths. And what's new and in the 21st century is studies saying, okay, what is it that's causing it? So I think the big thing, you know, if you're already doing those other things, what's the one thing you should take this year? You should take a long walk. There's good evidence that says that if you exercise 3.5 hours each week, that is going to give you more benefits than just about anything else that you can do.
You know, the designers of this convention center must have known that.
Now, this is slightly different from what everybody hears. Okay, so this is, you know, this is what you've seen before, I'm quite sure. So this is just looking at a group of people. You're looking at the relative risk of death. So a thin person, the relative risk, you could call that one. And in comparison, if you're overweight, that's a body mass index between 25 and 30. Well, your relative risk goes up. And if you're obese, which means that your body mass index is over 30, your risk is just sky high. And so in this case, yeah, you know, just looking at age, if you're obese, you're in trouble. And if you also take into account the bad luck, you've got family history of diseases, yeah, you're still in trouble. And even in accounting for the do-it-yourself luck, you know, you take care of your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and your glucose, you're still out of luck if you're obese. Except there's one thing that people don't always talk about, which is that when you take one other thing into account, which is your fitness level, suddenly that swoop disappears. That if you're obese, but you're really fit, you're doing 3.5 hours of exercise each week, then your relative risk moves into the same zone as a thin person over an overweight person. It's called the obesity paradox. I'm not sure why it exists, but there it is. So if you've been having troubles losing weight, well, maybe the thing to do is just skip worrying about the weight and go straight into the fitness, because there's a lot of evidence about the fitness.
So does this basically mean, like, just because you're big, it doesn't mean that you're unhealthy kind of thing?
Right.
That's interesting.
And so one of the things is, like, you know, you go into the, you know, evidence-based medicine. You know, these studies come out. You know, maybe in the future they're going to find out, well, it was that, you know, there's some subtle effect that's causing it. And, you know, there's other reasons to not have all the weight. But, you know.
Like self-image or whatever.
Societal
pressures, that kind of thing.
But giving up on your health because you can't lose weight is not necessary, because you can still work on your fitness in many different ways, no matter what weight you are. And so that's just, you know, where it's coming from. There's other studies. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot of data out there. And, you know, I call this living with ambiguity. When you look at sort of, you know, a group of people and how they're dying each year and what body mass index they have, there's actually a fairly wide variation in which there's not a whole lot of difference. Extremely thin people, for various reasons, have a slightly higher risk of death. Overweight people as well. But it's not the, oh yeah, you should be really thin and never mind, you know, and avoid being overweight. And that's one of the reasons why it's good to be looking at the data rather than sort of, you know, hearing what they're saying in the popular press. So actually, the fourth thing that I say that people should do, you know, once you're doing these other things, yes, maybe think about taking a supplement. And here's the one supplement that I take. And you're saying, okay, you know, I know Ray Kurzweil. I know that he takes 250 supplements a day. Yeah, I take a multivitamin as well, which is fairly easy to do. You know, but beyond that, I take omega-3 fatty acids. And why I take it? Because there's a lot of good evidence that it's helpful, that it reduces the risk of inflammation, and inflammation is associated with many diseases. And there are studies coming out which show the biochemical pathways of why it helps. Now, one of the things I think that people should take before you really get into it is, you know, some basic class or test or work with people on learning how to read medical studies. Because when you go online and try to find this information, it's really difficult to get good data. Everybody will write about a particular supplement as if it's the cure for cancer. And that can be dangerous because, again, you can get overwhelmed with information, or, you know, you have 10 different people telling you to take 10 different things. Maybe it's good to be able to go in and, you know, somebody's saying something, well, go read the actual article instead of the newspaper summary of it. And so that's one of the things which is really different nowadays, is that, you know, again, you have the top-down studies, but you also have the biochemistry up. You know, benfotiamine is this wonderful example. It was discovered, you know, it's a fat-soluble vitamin B1. There's nothing fancy about it. It's not a prescription drug. And 20, 30 years ago, they started discovering that people with diabetic neuropathy, which is one of the worst side effects of diabetes, if they took this, it stopped getting worse, and it started to reverse. And this has been fairly well known for about 20 years. But just a few years ago, they also discovered why it works. They discovered three different biochemical pathways for what it was doing, for what it was fixing that was broken in the people who have too much sugar in their body. And there's going to be a lot more studies like this. And so when you're looking at what to take, you know, if you find something, you know, somebody suggesting that you take something, and you can find a biochemical pathway for why it works, I think that's a lot better than simply taking something because, oh, well, lots of people are suggesting it.
Like the press says, you should eat, you know, blueberries or something.
Exactly. I think, you know, once you've been doing this stuff, and this is actually part really my own personal story, is that, you know, start with the exercise, start with, you know, basic supplements, and then maybe get to the point where you're taking medical tests beyond just the fit going to your doctors. I think you should be in slightly better shape when you get your medical test, just in case it's going to affect your insurance. And because you've been having the cognitive behavioral therapy, and because you've already been practicing some healthcare, you'll be more prepared to handle the information that you're going to get. Because nowadays, yes, it's quite possible that you're going to get some very bad information. If you get a genetic test, you might find out that you are much more susceptible than the general population to Alzheimer's. On the other hand, you're also going to find many other people who have the same problem and who are going to start giving you suggestions for what you find.
I think this is a really important point. The whole point of measurement, right? So how many of you are coders out there that write code? Okay. How many of you actually optimize your code, like make it go faster or make it smaller? Okay, what's the first thing you have to do before you optimize your code? Who said profile? Okay, you're right. Before you optimize your code, you have to figure out, like, well, how slow is it? How fast is it? Where are the fast and slow points? If you just start, like, randomly changing things, you might be fixing something. You might be making it faster, but you might not be making, like, the slowest part faster, for example. Optimizing code, like optimizing your body, not that different in that way. Go get your measurements. Go get profiled, which basically means going to the doctor and figuring out, like, okay, well, what is, you know, basic things even. Like I said, cholesterol level, blood glucose level, heart rate, blood pressure, and there's like a ton more, right? You can get, some people go out and get like hundreds of different things measured. You don't need to necessarily start with that. Start with a few and then ask your doctor, this is where I am now. This is my baseline. What should I be at? Right? And I think that's one of the sort of, methodologies I want to like put forward to you guys to like walk away with is that measurement and then trying to optimize that measurement toward some goal or, you know, progressively makes a lot more sense than saying, oh, I want to lose 10 pounds. Okay. It really is like, if you think of it as optimization rather than just as like, diet or whatever other sort of short-term framing, it's going to make a much bigger difference.
Doing that and just making sure that you have the right tools for being able to handle what you're about to do. I say take a cooking class before going on to any next steps that you'll see, because like food is something which is, you know, as everybody says, it's central to our experience. We love food. Primates are, you know, we re-evolved color vision because we like fruits and vegetables and colorful things. And if you look at people who live in a hunter-gatherer society, which I think represents all, you know, it's like all of our ancestors, you know, the Kung people in South Africa, you know, on a regular basis, they have a choice of 75 different types of vegetables that they're eating in a particular season. You know, our ancestors love a wide variety of food. And so if you try to go on a diet where you're really seeing only 5 things that you can eat each day, that's not going to work very well unless you're extraordinarily disciplined. But, you know, if you're a foodie, you know, having some cooking classes, building a toolkit.
Anyone here taking a cooking class? Okay, I got a few people. Did it change the way that you ate afterwards? Yes, no, mixed. Okay, yeah, definitely. Interesting.
Okay. There's a lot of evidence that you should be eating 10 servings of vegetables and fruits a day. And if you do this, it's going to have a lot of healthful effects. It's going to reduce your appetite. You're going to be feeling full. You're going to be getting a lot of fiber. You're going to be a lot of nutrients, which you aren't getting. But 10 servings is difficult. You know, if you're just simply trying to steam broccoli each and every day, some people can handle it. Some people, it would be almost impossible after 2 days. With the cooking class, you'll know what to do with this. Now, at that point where, you know, you figured out how to eat well, you know, how to read medical literature, you know, maybe this is the point where you can start saying, you know, should I be taking other supplements? And in this case, you'll find that there's a giant spectrum. You've got the Ray Kurzweils of the world who are taking 250. You know, you've got other people who aren't taking any at all. Well, how are you going to know which person you want to emulate? Well, one of the things you can do is you've already learned what you're capable of doing in any given time. And if you're not the sort of person who can really sit down each day and map these things out, 250 isn't for you. Maybe you just find, you know, the 2 or 3 things which are going to give you the biggest bang for the buck. Now, one of the other things I'm going to mention is that there's a lot of studies about reduced caloric diets, which is, you know, eating less, you know, it's not eating less than what you're eating right now. It's eating less than your optimal amount, but still having full nutrition. There's evidence in every animal that they've studied this, and this, you know, everything from mice to people, that people who are doing this, you know, all of their symptoms of aging start to freeze or in some cases reverse a little bit. So they'll have, you know, a 50-year-old person who has the heart of a 35-year-old, which wouldn't be a bad thing. But this is hard to do. Now, one way, you know, to be able to do it, first of all, you have to be ready to do it. You have to have all of the information. You have to be able to cook really well. And you have to have a lot of motivation. And so, you know, unless you've followed these other steps, I think doing, you know, just deciding to dive right into this would be really impossible. The good news with the reduced caloric diet is there's also evidence that you can do it every other day and get almost the same amount of benefits. And so what I'd say is, in summary, there's so much information out there that really the best thing to do is find somebody who is an early adopter and get advice from them.
How do you find people that are early adopters of these types of supplements? That aren't crazy.
Well, they're crazy. So I think this is one of the things that the web is giving us, and you know, it's really just starting. The web is giving us the ability to find groups of people who are working on this and who are willing to talk about why they're doing it. You know, if you find one group of people and they write about it and they talk about each study which is supporting what they're doing, that's better than somebody who just says, oh, you should take it because I believe it.
Have you found that there's like blog aggregates or something of people who've actually done like personal studies, started taking something, know the reason why, and see how that changes?
Yes, I do. I mean, in a lot of cases, you know, like everything else, right now we're still in the early adopter stage for most of this stuff. And so for the caloric restriction people, they're people who are going all out on the caloric restriction. And they write about, you know, what they're doing, what their vital symptoms are. And they'll also talk about the negatives. I mean, if you're doing full caloric restriction and your metabolism goes down, you don't have a lot of stamina. And so they talk about that as well. For supplements, there's groups like LEF, Life Extension Foundation, where they have forums where people will talk about the many different types of supplements that they're taking, and they'll talk about what it was like when they started it and why.
So what about even simpler, like instead of just going to like external resources, how about just talking to your friends? I mean, almost everyone here probably has friends they know who seem healthier or more physically fit than they are, right? I mean, I know I do. I have friends that are like, okay, like how are you that healthy or how are you that fit? And certainly that's what made a difference for me with my friend Leah, kind of like pushing me into like, you know, change some habits. To me, I think that combines the sort of like cognitive therapy aspect, because, you know, you vent to your friends, right? And your friends give you both, you know, will both slap you down and also, you know, support you when you need it. Why not start with that?
Yeah, I think that's the best, one of the best ways to do is, you know, find one thing that you want to do. And, you know, like I say, with my case, with all of this information, I did find myself sort of overwhelmed with it, but I was talking with other people and sort of came to the conclusion, well, if there's any one thing that I should take beyond a multivitamin, it should be, you know, omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils, or there's also vegetarian options for that. And so after talking with them and hearing what type they were taking, I went out and got some on my own. And then also talked with people about, you know, what can go wrong with it. If you go to Costco and get the giant bottle of fish oil, it's probably likely to start going bad before you even get a third of the way through the bottle. So in a case like that, somebody gave some good advice. It's like every 2 weeks, take one of the pills, open it up, and smell it. And if it's smelling like it's starting to go rancid, like any oil is capable of doing, just got to go throw it out. You know, maybe you're better off going to Trader Joe's and buying a small bottle that you'll be able to use in time.
So we have about 10 minutes and we'll do some Q&A. So if you guys can go to the microphone, actually, because we are podcasting this, that'd be great to record the questions. Thanks, Catherine.
Are you all vegetarians?
I'm pescatarian, so I eat fish in addition to being vegetarian. But I actually, interestingly, asked that. About a month ago, I cut out liquid milk from my diet, which was one of these sort of like, again, sort of the drafting sort of philosophy. I got that from Sean, just visiting him, and tried it and realized that soy milk, somehow they made it not suck in the last 10 years. And that's good. That's what it took for me to switch that. So
I think they just put milk in it now, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'm still in the cooking class stage.
Okay.
I'm vegan, so.
Okay. So one question I had about like being a vegetarian, and when I hear it described, they say, I've got a lot more energy and, you know, I just feel better. But like, what does that mean? Like, what does it feel like to have more energy? Does it feel like a cup of coffee? Does it feel like a Snickers bar? Does it, you know what I mean? Like, what do you mean better?
You know how like when you eat a ton of food and you're like, oh, I'm tired, I'm gonna go like sit on the couch for a while or whatever?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. Oh. So you have more energy because you're not like, you don't eat and then you're okay. just like, oh, I'm destroyed. Like you eat and you're like, all right, let's go do something else now.
And so like, are you,
sell your cup.
Huh?
What year did you sell your cup?
So are you sitting there and you're just like, I feel awesome.
No,
you just don't feel crappy as much.
You know, it's something that sort of like you realize that you stopped feeling like shit.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Like, oh wow. Like I didn't even realize that this sucked until it stopped sucking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so, some of that. Here's an analogy. Like when you're indoors, when you cooped up indoors and you like walk outside and it's like a bright sunny day, how do you feel?
Good.
Yeah. So that's one of the sort of impacts that like I can certainly share. Like that's when you say like how does it feel? That's kind of what it feels like. That jump.
Okay. And then one other quick question I had was like being a vegetarian and like you said, there's social awkwardness and stuff like that. So you know, if you're on a trip like this, or if you find yourself on an RV where they only serve nachos and vodka, like, do you just make sure that you got an apple in your bag at all times? Or, like, how do you deal with those kinds of situations? Do you just go, oh, okay, give me the nachos and vodka?
Okay, I think you get the first Cliff Bar question prize of the day.
All right.
So. Thank you. That's one of the answers right there. Figure out some snack food that you like that's like super healthy and just like keep it in your bag. And okay. So when you're in a situation where you're like, okay, it's been 3-4 hours since I've eaten, I'm hungry, and now all of a sudden I'm surrounded by crap. That just my limbic system, you're like sort of like reptilian brain is like telling you eat right now. You're like, okay, I can pull out
first drink a glass of water
and sure. you know, snack on it.
Okay. Well, that's awesome and all, but like I hate carrying stuff around. So like I'm not you know, the kind of person that has like, I always have like snack food and crap. Like I know where I can eat and where I can't eat. And if I know I'm going someplace where I probably won't have options, I just eat something ahead of time. You know, like I as far as like, you know, oh, bending the rules, like that doesn't really work. Like for veganism anyway, like your body's not really supposed to digest dairy. So like when you stop, your body goes, oh, cool. I don't have to worry about figuring this stuff out anymore. And so then if you don't eat it for a long enough period of time and then you start eating again, it's sort of like food poisoning. Like if I eat dairy right now, my body's like, ah, poison berries, throw up. So, it's not something I can just like, oh, well, I'll sure. just do it today and not worry about it. Like if there's like cheese that ends up in my food, I'm sick for like 3 days.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's like something I have to know, like I'm pretty regimented about it.
Okay.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I'm curious about the sort of ways in which you optimize your diet and your activities. There are a couple different things you can optimize for, right? So there's looking a certain way, you know, conforming to what fashion dictates a good body looks like. There's optimizing for physical performance, whether it's rock climbing or, you know, competing in a certain sport. There's optimizing for mental performance and flow and focus. And there's optimizing for longevity. And each one of these is going to have different sorts of things that you do. For instance, if you're optimizing for longevity, you're probably going to restrict your calories, where if you're optimizing for athletic performance, you're not. So I'm wondering what, if you guys have any sort of specific kinds of optimizations that you're
oh my goodness.
Going for. And
that's a huge question. I mean, I'll tell you what, panelists, one sentence response to that. Like, you know, which optimization do you pick and why? One sentence.
I don't optimize anything. I mean, I just
good answer.
Yeah, I mean, like this is what works for me, so I just do it. Yeah, there's not. I don't ever like measure anything out and be like, oh, this is better. So it's just it's what works.
I guess I optimize for endurance, strength, endurance, focus. I mean, that's pretty much the three cornerstones of yoga. So.
I love to read, and I have a goal, which is I'd like to be able to read 1 million books in my life, and so I'm optimizing for that.
Cool.
Focus and longevity.
Focus and longevity.
Yeah.
I'm trying to develop superpowers, but next.
I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to add on to some of the stuff that everybody said. In my own personal experience, I've lost 110 pounds over the course of 6 years. Thank you. And one of the things I wanted to add on to what you said, kind of one of the things that you said, Catherine, was that kind of the importance of really good nutrition and eating really good food. And one of the things that you kind of mentioned, but with vegetables, a lot of people don't like vegetables, but as Tantek said, over time, your tastes change for what you like to eat. You may end up finding once you start making small. Personally, I made small incremental changes, and that's what got me to make other changes where, you know, at this point in time, what my life was like 8 years ago is completely different, and the way I am physically and my energy and everything is completely different too. So I just wanted to say for anybody who's trying to do that, don't leave out vegetables and fruits and stuff. And also, I have to make a plug, try to go organic, because there actually has been studies proven, and I don't know if Catherine's seen this, but that it's actually more nutritionally dense. And it actually has more bioavailable elements in it. So
yes, awesome. I've seen those. There's good evidence for that.
Those are some really good points, actually. So I'm going to give you like three really quick hacks to take home from some of the points you brought up. The first is that it's actually a meta hack, which means it's self-describing. That's recursive, which is that if rather than avoiding doing one thing, rather than telling yourself to avoid doing something, give yourself instead an alternative to do something else. Okay, so that's the first thing. Like, instead of saying like, oh, don't eat this, like eat this instead. The second thing is, rather than like making a massive change, make an incremental change, right? Because like, I think all of us have experienced that, like making small incremental changes make a big difference. And then you brought up changing your tastes. This is a really big deal, and it's one of those things that I think is just really amazingly, like, I discovered. I decided on a whim to try unsweetened toothpaste. Like, I tried Tom's of Maine. You know, they're not a sponsor, but I tried this, Tom's of Maine. It tasted really weird for about a week. And then it tasted okay. And then everything else tasted sweeter. It was really weird. So, like, the odds are that most of you are using sweetened toothpaste. And think about this from a perspective of, like, what it's doing to sort of, like, your tongue and, like, what it makes you think is normal tasting. Well, it's actually sweet tasting. When you do that, I guarantee you that vegetables and fruits will taste so much better that, like, you'll have a strawberry, you'll be like, wow, that's amazing. Try that. Just try it for, like, you know, a week or two and see what food tastes like. Go ahead.
Hey, I was wondering, all of you seem to have had a rather lengthy journey to fitness. And do you think that was a key element, that it took years? Or do you believe that a person can, you know, revolutionize easily?
So for me, I mean, the big change for me happened in about 5 months from, like, being totally unhappy with my body and just, like, out of shape to being basically in better shape than I've been since high school. It was just, like, I didn't think I could get back to that. It was just weird.
I think the big trick is that it's not like you're just, like, doing this one thing and then it fixes everything and then you know, it's not an issue anymore. It's like you're making a lifestyle change that then once that applies, it continues on, you know, for the rest of your life. So it's not... It becomes a long-term thing, even though some of the results might be a bit quicker.
Yeah, you're not just doing a repair, yeah. Right? You're deciding to make like a change to like how you're going to be for the rest of your life, right? It's an identity thing.
Well, in particular, I noticed, I believe your name is Noelle, right?
Yes.
You seem to do cumulative things, and actually you did as well, Sean, where you started off vegetarian or you started off going to the gym, or your first move was cutting out the bad food. And then from there, over the course of years, it was veganism and then some cycling and then eventually abolishing the use of your car.
Right.
And in your case, you became hardcore yoga and now rock climbing, right? Do you feel like you could have adopted this new lifestyle and shed your old skin in a really short period of time?
I mean, I think Tantek has the best kind of perspective on this, but yes, I mean, it's easy. Not easy, but making incremental changes is really what kicks it in. I mean, really solidifies it. You can't just like overnight say, oh, I'm going to do yoga 10 hours a week, right? Hmm. But, you know, making that change, you can make it over a shorter period of time. Like instead of, you know, me going to one yoga class a week for 3 months, you can shorten that. You can say, okay, well, fine, I'm going to go to one yoga class a week for a month. And then two for a month, and then three for, and you could shorten that time frame as much as you want. But the key is to keep moving forward with those increments, and as fast as you can move forward with those increments,
and change your lifestyle. That's as fast as you can go.
I think it's, I mean, what you're able to do, like, on an individual level varies from person to person. You know, some changes you can do really quickly. Like, I mean, anybody could go vegan tomorrow, no problem. You know, I mean, that's not something that's impossible to do. It's just you want to do it or not. But you couldn't necessarily say someone who hasn't ridden a bike in years, like, okay, you're going to start riding 40 miles a day. You know, like, sure, they just wouldn't be able to physically do it. So, you know, some things just are gradual because that's what it takes. You know, like, I didn't just jump into that. I ride my bike more because I started riding my bike more.
So we're actually out of time.
Thank you.
So thanks for your question. I want to leave you guys with just one thing, which is we actually have a wiki set up, bodyoptimization.pbwiki.com. And I just pulled up a page here that's sort of relevant to the question of, you know, making changes and incremental and all that. If you see that little area to the lower right of your brain, the reptilian brain there, that's the part that's like very habitual and doesn't like changing habits at all. Like, really, that's the part like either makes you keep a habit or makes you resist like adding a new habit. And the whole point of doing things incrementally is you're hacking that part of your brain. You're basically telling this sort of like, you know, unconscious, you know, subconscious reptilian part of your brain, I know that you don't like to change the habits, but I'm going to change it really slightly. I'm going to trick you, right? It's sort of like boiling a lobster kind of thing, right? There's a lot more on here that, you know, we don't have time to go into, but we'll be hanging out here for a few minutes. If you have more questions, you'll come up and ask. Otherwise, thank you very much.